My name is Joni, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that that we may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization, which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons are Phil and Dino, and they have a list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Joanne will read the preamble.
My name's Joanne, and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Sarah will read the steps.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Hi. Okay. Bill will read the traditions.
I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Twelve traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Least problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Here I am again. Okay. Okay. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Jenny. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jenny. I'm an alcoholic. I am so grateful to be here right now, and my emotions are kind of like this because you guys have changed me today. And I am now a woman of dignity and great grace. Like, it's so beautiful how much this program has changed my life today. A little bit about me. My sober date is 11-18-08. I have a sponsor. Her name is Jeannie H. She has a sponsor. She has a sponsor. And that row is right there. They're all looking at me. So there's my family. And I have a home group, and it's AG. And I'm just so grateful for this program. Let's see. I really want to focus on the newcomer tonight. So any newcomers that are kind of on the fence, if you're an alcoholic, just see if you can relate to one thing that I say or what any of the speakers say tonight. And see, you know, just give it some thought. But and just know that you're so welcomed here. You're welcomed. You're not alone anymore. You can sit back and relax and enjoy tonight. So a little bit about me. I was raised outside of Buffalo, New York, in the suburbs of Williamsville. I came from a very, you know, suburban family, conservative. I did not like them whatsoever. And the cool thing is that because of this program now, I love them. You know, I was, and that's what's so ironic, right? And so I was that type of a child. I had a hard time learning. Like, I was diagnosed with dyslexia, ADHD at a young age. My summers were with like student teachers, and like, you know, that's what I did every summer, and they felt bad for me, so they always gave me the classroom pet, and they're like, oh, Jenny can have the pet because she has to be tutored every summer. So that was kind of in a nutshell how it was. And I came from a very academic family, and, you know, doctor, lawyer, that's what they want. And, you know, here I am, the artsy fartsy girl. But you know what? That's God's gift to me today, and that's what's so cool. It's another thing I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous. So going on, I have this thinking that really gets, you know, down on me, and it's really hard. And that's why I believe I was born with alcoholism. You know, I have this thinking, and it's just like this anxiety, this God-sized hole that is in me, and I want to fill it up. And how? What can I fill it up with? I'm going to do it with alcohol. I'm going to do it with drugs, men, whatever, clothing, whatever. And throughout my whole life, that's what I was always doing all the time. You know, and because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it is good. I'm going to just tell you briefly about some drinking stories, but I mainly want to say that there's a solution in this room today, and there really is. Briefly, you know, my first drink, 11 years old. I come from a family of alcoholics. I do. And, you know, I was always asked to, like, hit Manhattan, 9 years old, and make Manhattans for my grandparents. And it was interesting because I didn't really pick up alcohol until I was about 14, 15 years old. I was invited to a very well-known alcoholic distributor's daughter's wedding, and it was in Virginia Beach. And, yeah, I remember I was like, I have arrived. What am I doing here? I'm an adult. They're giving me unbelievable amount of liquor. All I have to do, I was like, I must look good. And it was and what do you think I did right away? The cause and the effect. Here it starts. Ready? I start drinking, and then all of a sudden, I run out on the strip of Virginia Beach. I found myself a guy. And I was under the care of my best friend's parents. And I came home to that hotel at 5 in the morning, and they could have thought I was dead. I didn't think about that. I was like, Jenny was having a good time. That wasn't it. And so, and that is how alcoholism is for me, the cause and effect. I do not see how it hurts people. You know, I just want it to hurt me. Like, I want it to just fill me up and just take away any issues that might come over me and stuff. So when that happened, my best friend approached me and she said, Jenny, this really hurt me. And God forbid if I hurt anyone else. You can hurt me as much as possible, but God forbid that you, if I hurt anyone like my best friend. And I put it aside. For years, I didn't start really pick up another drink till 21, but I had that thinking. I had that thinking. I had the men in my life, the men grabbing for men. Oh, I'm going to move out to New Mexico and ditch my parents. They didn't know where I was for 6 years. My parents thought I was dead for 6 years, you know. And going on, though, I had that thinking, and that's me being a dry drunk, though, you know. And here it is. There's the thinking. So at the age of 21, I pick up the drink again. And it wasn't at my 21st birthday. It was that summer. I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and Run and Rome, you do what the Romans do, and I was drinking bourbon, Maker's Mark. And, you know, and for years, ever since now, where I'm standing about a year ago, November 18th, I was just 24/7, and I filling it up. And I did substance too, but it was always alcohol, and it was always, you know, and it started and ended with alcohol. And I want to get more into the solution today because that is the old Jenny. I want to say that's the old Jenny. I'm a new Jenny today, and that's what's so cool. This, and that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can talk about my old behavior, but I want to share something with you. There is a solution in this room, like I mentioned before. And this program, I have a family here today, and I just have such, like, my life today has changed so much. Like, I live in a beautiful, sober household now. 3 bedrooms, like, gorgeous floors. Right, Mike? I see Mike. And it's funny because it's like where I was living before, I didn't have walls. I was living in a huge studio apartment. And I was living in not such a healthy, like, place at all. And my life is, like, just changing. And my sponsor is helping me walk through it, too. Any situation that comes up, it was just, it's amazing. And these steps, we have tools today for being an alcoholic. We have the steps. We have the big book. Anyone that, if you do not have a sponsor, get a sponsor. It's like, don't listen to yourself anymore. I'm going to just say that. I'm just going to say it out, get a sponsor. It didn't work for me when I just turned to me all the time. And so, but it was just, this program, I don't know, it's... so much has changed, you know, like I have a prayer partner in every morning, and like I found a connection that I'm not God anymore. I'm not God. And the cool thing is I was able to find my own God, my own understanding within this program because of this program. And I can sit back and say, you know, Jenny, this life is simple, you know, and I don't have to grab for a drink anymore. And I don't have to grab for, you know, like any type of substance. I can fill it with my higher power. Excuse me, I'm going to have a drink. But that's what this program has given me. There's a solution to my thinking today. You know, there's a solution to this emptiness that I have, that God-sized hole. How am I going to fill it today? And I'm going to be doing it with service. When I'm of service to others, I'm out of Jenny's head. That's what it comes down to. And when I'm an example, you know, it's like my life is just different, you know? And I can live it in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but am I living it outside of this building right now? You know, am I going on the subway and being like, oh, you know, no, I want to bring it with me and be like, there's something about that girl that's completely different than everyone else. And that's That's God, though. That's my higher power. My higher power I like to call God. And for any newcomer, if the God thing kind of freaks you out, give it time. It works. I'm baffled of how much it is. And this meeting, this is so cool. I finally get to speak in front of everybody. This is my family here. AG is my family. It's amazing. And like this, I don't know, so many people, the people that came and approached me before I came up here, the people that prayed with me, you know, I want to thank everybody, my sponsor, Rajesh, you know, all these people. I never had people in my life like that before. You know, and like, because of this program too, I have people in my life. And like, I have my family back today. And my alcoholic family that I wanted to kick and put aside and never speak to them again, I was able to do a beautiful amends to them. And you know, that's what we do today. We do things that we don't want to do, and that's what it's all about. And I'm just so grateful for that. And you know, for any newcomer, give me your number if you're still like questioning this. I'm going to be standing up here shaking everybody's hands at the end, and I would love to get your number. I would love to speak to you. Know that you are not alone. This program works. I don't think a church filled of 500 people would be coming in together every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock on 60 in the park if it didn't. And so I just want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak. There's a solution today, and I just want to share that. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. So our second 10-minute speaker is John. Yeah. Welcome. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Jerome for asking me to speak. I don't know where you are. There you are, buddy. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Stacy, for giving me some good advice earlier today. Got a little bit nervous about what I was going to say to you. I got sober November 5th of 2001. My home group is the Atlantic Group, and I'm working on steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. I'm from Newport News, Virginia. I was born there. I'm the product of a dentist and a fashionista, and they got together and moved to Virginia, and they had me. That's the end of the story. Scary. I don't know what it is, but when I was a little kid, you know, I was like 2-3 years old, I had these friends and they were all like a little bit wild. And I swear, I look back at it now, I'm almost sober 8 years, they're all alcoholics and drug addicts. I don't really understand it. But I'm just attracted to those types of people from the age of two. I had my first drink when I was like 4 or 5 years old. My mom used to have these dinner parties at the house, and she served creme de menthe liqueur, or she had it on a cocktail table. And I thought it was really cool, and it tasted like a mint, so she let me take a sip of it. I didn't remember until I was 2 years sober. I used to go into the liquor cabinet and go take sips of it when they weren't looking. I used to chug bottles of vanilla extract at the age of four. I don't know if I got drunk. I just liked the taste of it. Eventually, my parents got divorced and moved here to New York. You know, and on the outsides, everything appeared great, but on the insides, I was just totally broken. My parents would send me away to camp for like 3 months or 2 months at a time in the summer from the age of six, and I was just so lonely and depressed and felt alone in this world. And that just continued, you know, on until I got older. And I was growing up here in New York. I knew Jerome when I was 13 years old. We used to drink together. And we lived across the street from each other. And so, you know, by the age of like 13, 14, I was just like a total raging alcoholic. You know, I've got learning disabilities. I'm the troublemaker. I'm the class clown, always acting out. I was a good athlete. And something happened, you know, a couple friends of mine, we went and got a six-pack of Coors Light. I was like 14 years old, a pack of Camelite cigarettes, went over to this girl's apartment, drank. You know, in New York City, if you grow up here, nobody's parents are around. They're all out to parties or they're, you know, going to dinner. So it was always like a house to go have a party at. And I totally, like, could do whatever I wanted to do. My mom was working and, you know, I just was in total, it was a nightmare. Something happened. I didn't get drunk, but I felt like I belonged somewhere for the first time in my life. And that Coors Light just tasted horrible. It was coarse. Just tasted horrible. But I really liked the feeling, you know. And let's fast forward like four or five months later, I was just getting totally smashed. I love getting wrecked. I love drinking. I like getting drunk. I like having parties. Eventually, I was living on my own with my sister, and I was 15 years old. And my mom got remarried and just couldn't handle, you know, my drinking, my, you know, craziness. So I had my own apartment, and there was a party at my house almost every single night, you know, ninth grade. And it was the best year of my life. If I could do it over again, I would. Unfortunately, I spent the next 9 years trying to get that same feeling, and it never worked. Right when I was about 16 years old, I'll tell you one other story, and I'll get into a little bit of sobriety. My dad gave me a car on my 16th birthday, and I was in Virginia, and my dad still lived there. And my dad came from, like, nothing, right? And so he gave me this car. It was this beautiful two-door, four-seater roadster. And he's like, son, you know, I wish my father would have given me this. I'm so proud of you. I want you to enjoy it. And he had just bought a new car for himself. Fast forward, like, 3 or 4 hours later, Hank Berry, my buddy from when I was 2 years old, and a bunch of other kids were driving up into, like, farmland at, like, 12 o'clock at night. I lied to my dad where I was going to be. I drank, like, 8 beers, but I'm a New Yorker, and I'm 16 years old, so I can handle my liquor. That's nothing. Passed out, smashed the car into another car, rolled it off over in a ditch going 90 miles an hour, and it rolled over and over and over and over. And when the police came, I was just begging the police officer, if I grab your gun, will you shoot me? Because my dad's going to kill me. And he's like, nope. That was just the beginning of my story as an alcoholic. And it got to the point, I'll just fast forward it. I drank all different types of liquor, different types of places, different types of people. I always end up broke, sick, vomiting, head in a garbage can, you name it. That happens every time I drink. And it came to the point, I'm living in New York City. I didn't know if it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday, but I'm going out. And when I'd pick up a drink, all I wanted was an Amstel Light. All I wanted was a glass of wine, glass of champagne, a vodka, a Maker's Mark. Love that stuff. I'm gone for 48 hours at a time. And it gets scarier and scarier. Each hour, you know, the crowd changes. And I always love saying it. You know, the people you're hanging out with at 8 o'clock at night are not the people you're hanging out with 8 o'clock in the morning and 8 o'clock at night the next night. And they're the scariest people in the world. I think some of them are here tonight. So a little bit about sobriety. You know, I've seen the most amazing things happen in sobriety. I used to sit in the back. I was so terrified. If you would have told me almost 8 years ago I would actually be at this meeting and speaking, I would never have believed it, right? I was so scared of letting anybody know that I'm an alcoholic, and let alone, sit in the back of a meeting with a hooded sweatshirt over my head, and I just, like, say to myself, okay, I'm checking in here, I'm not listening to anything, and I'm going to get out of here before the meeting's over. I don't want to hold anybody's hands. And it's miraculous, right? I couldn't even balance a checkbook, pay my rent. I had to pay an entire year's rent in full because I knew I would drink all of, you know, the rent money away in a nanosecond. And I don't have to live that way anymore. And I have friends that I, you know, got before I got sober that are here. I have friends that I've made while I'm here, guys from, like, the first, you know, couple months of sobriety. And it's amazing the changes. People look different. If you see someone and they're counting days and they stay here, watch them. If they start doing the work a year in, 2 years in, their lives, it's a miraculous change. You can't even imagine. I look at people 6 months later, I'm like, wait, that's you? You know, they lose 15 pounds, they look great, they have color in their eyes, you know, they don't look pale white and a ghost. But that's what it's like. We're like the living dead, and we get life brought into us. And it's an amazing thing for a guy that never knew what a life was like, right? So I was totally miserable and just trying to medicate myself, and I was really just trying to drink myself to death. I lived my life thinking I would never live past the age of 25. And then I thought I would never live past the age of 30. But I couldn't even imagine it, you know? And so I never prepared for school. I never really cared about anything except getting wrecked. And I don't live that. My life is totally the opposite today. But I've seen amazing stuff, like friends that said, I've had sponsees, like, I just had a bad breakup. I have no job. I have no money. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no job. They've got a great job. They have a wife. They have a baby. They have another baby. They bought a house. They're, you know, member at a country club. They still complain about how their life sucks, but, you know, for all appearances, it's great. So it's not about just getting this stuff. but waking up in the morning and feeling good about myself. I used to wake up every single morning feeling like the most worthless human being in the world and saying I'm still here, or I'd wake up and I'd feel like I have to vomit, or my eyes are burning, or what lie do I have to make up, or I'm late, or what am I going to do? And I wake up and I feel good. We have an opportunity today. I have to go to work. I have a dog. I take care of the dog. The dog still likes me. The dog has been fed twice a day for 3 years. You know, and it's an amazing thing because I can't function like a human being. AA gives me the tools to live on a daily basis without drugs and alcohol, gives me the ability to be friends, to have a family. You know, my dad, let me tell you, he wasn't very happy with me for a good 10 years, but eventually we've been able to have a relationship. I can't believe it. You know, my parents must have spent their entire fortune, you know, on therapy, et cetera. And you come here for a dollar a day. That's it. And it mended those relationships. So I can tell you anything is possible. I am so fear-stricken. I am scared of, like, water. I'm scared of fish. I'm scared of dogs. I'm scared of cats. Scared of work. I'm scared of standing up in public. And I do it, you know? And I remember I used to have this service commitment. I was a little nervous because I didn't know what I was going to say, and I still don't know what I'm saying. But I used to have this service commitment up here, and Stacy, my sponsor, used to have to hold my hand before the meeting started, and I was literally shaking, and I was like, I can't do it. I'm terrified. And he's like, you can do it. You can do it. And it has prepared me in life to stand in front of all of you beautiful alcoholics. And I hope you all have, like, a great sobriety and get the gifts that I've gotten. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Ava.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ava, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, what a reception. It's an honor and a privilege to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's really... It's a great gift to speak to the home group. You guys are so terrific. And tonight you have the Fashionista panel. And I was definitely, John and Jenny both did such a great job, and I had a lot of identification with both of them. And I was the 8 a.m. crowd, and I was definitely chasing boys. And I have been restored to sanity in that regard to some degree. All right, well, let's talk about alcoholism and recovery, shall we? I'm a nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn. There's no alcoholism in the family other than mine. There's a lot of mishigas. For glossier of terms, Siavi and Bonnie. There was a lot of anxiety. I think it's part of the, you know, just the Jewish culture. Everything is like, oi, and, you know, and everything's doom, you know, and it's all coming to an end, in, you know, at any given moment. Like, some of it's cultural, and my father was born in Russia, and his family, certainly, they lived under the threat of the Cossacks. It was real, and that kind of fear is still in the culture of the family. There were no Cossacks in Sheepshead Bay, but we were waiting for them. And I did not like my family either. I thought I was adopted, and if you would see my parents, I am like a clone of them. But I felt like an alien in my own family. If you could be born with this disease, I was born with it. And I just needed to add alcohol, but I had the mindset and I had the self-centered fear, which I believe the core of alcoholism is extreme self-centered fear. And when I add alcohol, the fear is somewhat diminished, or I just really don't care. So I'm just like blotto. And I drank to blotto, I drank to oblivion, and I made a career out of it. And it was a very innocent beginning. I'm a late bloomer. I think I was 14. We didn't drink. It was the boys in the high school band. It was even junior high band in the garage band with the Thunderbird. Right away, you know, I mean, Thunderbird is a first drink, we have a problem already. I mean, you know, like, and Boone's Farm. I mean, that was my drink of choice. I went back to school, first day of high school, I went to school with like the tan suede pouch. My accessory was the wine pouch. People have pencil cases. You know, I'm featuring the tan suede red wine pouch that I had shoplifted, which is the other, you know, the other thing. A little shoplifting in my story. And actually a lot of shoplifting. And truth be told is that I started to steal. It's a big part of my alcoholism in my story, because really what stealing is about is I want what I want when I want it. So I started with candy. And actually I have this like major thing for sugar. Just forget, like that's a telltale sign. Warning, if you have a child that eats sugar the way I did, take them to therapy or something. Although I don't know that therapy is really going to work on what this is. It could be, it's as a side order, it's very useful. But one-on-one with alcoholism, it's not going to cut it. So anyway, I was out of my mind for candy. And I could never get enough candy, so I would steal the candy that I wanted. And I knew right from wrong. And so I would steal the candy, and then I would know that I had just done something that I shouldn't do. And I would be remorseful, and remorse feels awful. And I would give me like a knot in my stomach, and then I would just eat more candy. And that would take care of the, you know, the remorse. But I truly believe that, you know, I was making like a black mark on my spirit, and it's cutting me off from that connection with the world and the universe, which I had at times as a young child. I did have a connection. It would be very fleeting. A book talks about it. Sometimes it would be blotted out, and sometimes we would have connection. I went to Hebrew school, and the only way you can get me, and I went to synagogue on Saturday, and the only way they got me out of the bed was the promise of the chocolate bar that we would get after we went to services. But, you know, that connection, there was something there. And I'm not quite, you know, we prayed in a language I didn't understand, but it felt good anyway. So I truly believe in prayer, and it does work. And I don't even need to believe or even know what I'm saying, because most of the prayers I said, I didn't really know what the translation were. But it did feel good to me. And then, you know, puberty struck, which was terribly unfair. You know, as you know, I'm boy crazy, and I've been boy crazy since around kindergarten. And it doesn't get any better. I had, I think Robert Hamworker gave Lori Suffian the red go-go ring in the fifth grade, and that was it. I was crushed. I was on my fourth step because I had a resentment with Robert Hamworker and Lori Suffian. I mean, and Lori was my best girlfriend. And, you know, and it was in me. And I made a decision based on self that, you know, I'm less than, I'm not as good as, it's easy to get rid of me. This is in my mind. I discussed them with no one. I didn't even realize that I had made those kind of decisions, or that's what I told myself, or that's how I felt about myself, because I had no awareness. All of my understanding of my feelings and my place in this universe came to me once I was sober. So all of this is in retrospect. So I had no self-awareness whatsoever. I'm really totally out to lunch person. I never knew what I liked or what I didn't like. And I got my cue from you, because I needed your approval or affirmation. So I would always look to you to kind of tell me who I was supposed to be, or if I was doing okay or not. So it turned into lots of people pleasing, which I used to say with like a badge of honor, oh, I'm a people pleaser, which is actually like saying, oh, hi, I'm a really dishonest and self-serving individual. How are you? But I would say, oh, I'm such a people pleaser. Like it was like, you know, anyway, more about that later. So, because I needed you to like me, so I would have to do whatever it was in order to solicit the response that I thought that I needed, which is, you know, that's like a lot of crazy. If you're following me, I think you're in the right room. It's getting hot in here. It's a lot of stuff. And that's my thinking. It's very, woo, woo. It's very, like, pyramid thinking, okay? You know, I have that kind of thinking that it's like an inverted pyramid. You know, I have a scratch on my shin. It's going to be gangrene. It's getting infected. I'm an amputee. I mean, I haven't even, I had a mosquito bite. It's craziness. But you know what? When I'm alone in my head with that stuff, I'm nuts. And I can't just say, oh, stop thinking about that. That works well. It's like, oh, just don't have another drink. No, like, oh, stop thinking. If I could do that, we'd be back in Sheepshead Bay. I'd be roller skating up and down Sheepshead Bay Road. All would be well, and it was not well. So I roller skated up and down Sheepshead Bay Road, and I was a bright student, and I had dreams of medical school. I have an altruistic streak to my person. I like to be a good girl. I like doing things for other people. I like selling raffle tickets for cancer care. I like being of service. You know, I was a nice person and full of fear and totally self-absorbed. And I needed a drink. So often the speakers are all, I was an axe murderer and I was horrible. No, I was a really nice kid and I was really self-absorbed and self-centered, and I then made poor choices and I hurt a lot of people, but my basic Ava was okay. But I needed a drink in order to function. And finally, so we finally drank with the garage band, and it wasn't wonderful and it was Thunderbird, but it, you know, it was what it was and it worked. I'm back to school, and I started to drink, and I picked up drugs because that's what we did, and it was one thing led to the other. And if the alcohol did not give me that buzz that it gave me, I would have never opened the door because I was a goody-two-shoes, and I wanted to go to medical school, and everybody was starting to party, and I was no, 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 no. Then I drank, and everything broke loose, and it opened doors to lots of other things. Plus the pressure of self-centered fear of going to high school was starting to get, my world was small and in my head, and now the walls were closing in on me because I had more people to deal with and more boys to flirt with, and I did not know how to handle all of that. And I did a lot of drinking, daily drinking. I used to say, when I first got sober, I didn't even realize that I was an alcoholic because I had so many other things in my story, and so I had a lot of denial. And then as the smoke cleared and I stayed here, I began to understand what alcoholism was. I began to see the parts of my story. I began to see where I had the phenomenon of craving, which is when I pick up a drink, the drink needs another drink. I began to see where I would go out to do one thing and I would wind up doing something else when I picked up a drink. And I saw that I had this mental obsession and this physical allergy. And it was not as pronounced because I was much younger. And it was later on in my drinking story at the end when I was drinking in a bar on 8th Avenue called The Rawhide. There's no social drinking at The Rawhide. So this thing's very progressive, and I certainly did not start out saying, oh, I can't wait to get to the Rawhide in black leather. I did not. But anyway, and I loved it there because, you know, that's what happens is that I kept adjusting my people and my crowds to accommodate the progressed nature of my disease. I would just keep moving around and sorting things so that it would, you know, just lower my standards. That's it. When I look back over my drinking career, I realized I was a teen alcoholic, and I didn't even know it because I was really a potential alcoholic. I was 16. I had only just started drinking 2 years before, and I would drink, make plans to go out with the boys. Here we go. Get loaded, hang out with the boys. I can't even tell you how that ended. Not well. I had no self-esteem. I need affirmation, and I'm needy. This is not a good combination with alcohol. Add alcohol, instant floozy. And then I would hang out, and I would participate in ways I'm not so sure that I was really too thrilled about, but I don't have a no. I never had a no. I have a no now. I have an unbelievable no, okay? get a service commitment on the steering committee and you'll find out. Okay, we'll come back to that. Anyway, I had no, because I can't say no, because I'm, remember, people please herself, but okay. And then I get up the next day, I'm full of self-hatred. I've done it again. I'm swearing off. And then I'm young, so by 1 o'clock I feel a little better. By 2 o'clock the call comes in, and by 4 o'clock I'm making plans. And there I go out the door to do the same thing again. I'm living at home. I'm lying to my parents. I'm hiding what I'm doing. I'm lying to my parents. And I'm in this cycle of spree and remorse, and I'm 16, and I can't even see this. So I was a teen alcoholic, and I didn't even know it. Because, you know, there were so many other things going on. And I went to college, and I majored in lawn and platform shoes. And the student union building, I mean, the minute, it was all about, you know, I was a hippie for about 3 weeks because I didn't like the shoes. And then, of course, platform shoes came in the first time. Well, it wasn't even the first time, but it was the 70s. It was the second time. The 40s was the first time. And I had to have those shoes. And did I do a fit and a half to get my mother to buy me these shoes? And she still regrets that. And I just would run around. You cannot walk on a lawn in a pair of platform three-inch. It's not, especially on, you know, out of your mind on booze. I mean, all I did was drink all day, and I didn't go to class. And so, you know, that was the end of my medical career. You know what I mean? Because having fun and partying and being out of your mind with people was much more important than medical school and education. So, and the other, and I love to dance, which was the other thing, and I love to go to the clubs, and really that's my whole story is about, and then we went dancing. And every day in high school, every day after school, I would go home and we would practice dancing with my best friend, Victor. Victor was gay, he was my best friend in high school, and we were getting ready for the disco. Because back in the day, it was not user-friendly, and you had to know how to dance before you went to the club, which is not an easy trick. Otherwise, no one was going to dance with you. And then you could just imagine with my head, I'm the negative esteem person. So I wouldn't even get to this. So, of course, but with a drink, all things are possible. And so we got ready for the disco, and that's what I spent the next, 16, 18 years dancing. Wearing great shoes and dancing my way around every club in the five boroughs. And that's really, and it was all about the scene and the clubs and the DJs and the outfits and the shoes and the alcohol and the drugs and it was all about the scene. And it was, and that whole scene and that whole world was conducive to the drink. And it all supported the lifestyle. I didn't have a life, I had a lifestyle. And whatever normalcy I had abandoned in the name of a good time. That's my whole story, is in the name of a good time. Are we having a good time? We're having a good time. Let's party. So, party girl in Webster, it's me. That's my picture. And that's all we wanted to do, was to have a party. And it's very progressive. So, there was no more fun. You know, in the early days, it's so funny. I have so many... when I asked myself, was I having fun? A part of me had fun. Of course I did. I loved to dance, but I also always had that head that is like the alien on it with like, are you dancing okay? Do they like how you're dancing? Are they going to ask you how are you dancing? What do they think of your dancing? What do I think of my dancing? I mean, how could I even, oh my God. And then, in order to get rid of that, I mean, the consumption would have to be so enormous that who could even twirl if you were, by the time I would be so out of my mind because I had all that stuff. But truth be told, I always, deep down within, I always had this nagging, depressive, self-pitying, isolated. I was popular. Everyone wanted to hang out with me, but I always felt separated from you. There was always, like, I could not get close to you. And I lived alone in my head, and I lived in a lot of pain. And many nights when we would have this great night out, I would come home, and I would cry myself to sleep. And I didn't even know why I was crying.
And I was crying because I was an alcoholic and I was in psychic pain. And I'd spent so many years there. And sometimes sober, because it's alcoholism and it's really tricky. And then the progression of the disease just wiped out my life. And where I had some ability to work, I had talent and this, that, and the other thing, it took me out completely and I was just done. Unemployable, debt out of the, because I didn't work and all I did was spend. I mean, I had my first credit card when I was 16. I went shopping and I finally just paid the bill in 15 years ago. I mean, I'm sober a while. I'm sober 21 in 1988. I got sober March the 1st, 1988, the greatest day of my life. I thought I was dying and my life was over and my life was just beginning. It was the beginning. And so often I feel like that sometimes sober, where I feel like, oh my God, I'm dying, and really what it is, it's the end of a chapter and it's really the dawn of a new beginning. But my ego is such that it tells me lots of negative things, because that's such as a cycle of recovery and growth and change. It sometimes feels colorful, doesn't feel easy when it's going on. Early sobriety is that, can be that way too. I had a pink cloud. I was one of those manically happy to be sober people that you like to want like push under a car or something. I was like, oh my God! You know, I wound up in a detox. My girlfriends, my disco girlfriends with the hair and nail girls from Long Island. I mean, you didn't even hear that chapter. I mean, they were just great girls. And when it was time to go home, they went home. I don't understand what that means. I'm the 8 a.m. girl. And I want to know where else are we going? There is no end. I like combust. That's who I am. And I wound up in the detox, and they brought the meetings in, and I didn't, who knew about meetings? I mean, it was just like, oh my God, you mean there's a solution to this? There's a fellowship? And I was, of course, I was like, love at first sight with the fellowship, which is could be good and could be bad, if you're a girl like me. But I was just so excited to meet sober people, and they brought us meetings, and I said, whatever they do, I'm doing, that's it, I'm in. I'm in, I'm doing it, whatever it is. So I came in on the third step because I was absolutely willing to go to any lengths to do what they do. And I was willing to turn my will on my life, my thinking, my actions. That's really what the third step means. It's just, I'm going to give myself to this program, I'm not going to debate, I'm not going to argue, I'm going to do what they do. I had no idea what it was, but I was going to do it. And I met a guy in the detox, Craig, nice Jewish gay boy from Queens. Yes, God bless Craig. And he had 3 weeks of recovery, and he knew everything about sobriety. And he knew everything I needed to know, which was that we were going to go to a meeting. The minute, the nanosecond my foot hit the sidewalk, I was going to the meeting. He picked me up, and he took me. And I went with the bag with the clothes, the dirty laundry, to the meeting before I went home. And that was the start of my journey. And it's what a trip. And I was one of those, I was so excited to be sober because I was so beaten up from this illness. And I was exhausted and I was physically exhausted. And it was such a relief to be sober and just to be awake during the day. Although at the same time, I was so depressed. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but my chemistry was really bad. And I was, my body clock was upside down. I was a mess, but all I could do, thank God, and I was living with my parents, which is a whole nother chapter, and I was not happy about it. I'm so fortunate that I had parents that took me in, and I was incapable, the reality is I was incapable of taking care of myself, and I was too sick to be let loose in society, and I needed like care. I probably needed a long-term facility of some type because I couldn't work, and I couldn't sleep, and I couldn't eat, and I couldn't do anything. It was a wreck. And lucky me that I had parents that said, you can live with us. But of course, I was pissed off about it, you know, which is, you know, so alcoholic, you know. Someone's giving you something good, and you just don't like the wrapper. It's like, which is really AA. Here, we have this amazing gift of life for you. I don't want it. I have to call you every day. You know what I mean? Like, I'm dying, but don't tell me. Don't tell me I'm dying. I want to say I'm dying. If I say I'm dying, it's okay. Okay, so we're very interesting to help. It's very studio. Studio 54 attitude works the best. Make it just a little out of your reach and they want you. Sorry, you can't have my number. Oh, please, I need your number. We don't do that around here. We're nauseatingly helpful and welcoming, so I hope you can accept it. So welcome. I want to welcome all the new people and anyone who's new in at our group. Try and accept it. I know it's not easy. I have a receptor. I have a broken receptor. My love receptor is broken. That's really another piece of my personal makeup. My parents adored me. I'm like, who is that woman? I mean, that's how I was with my mother. I'm out of my mind. Thank God for A and the steps. It kind of helps me to see, oh my God, I'm out of my mind. That was a spiritual experience when I realized that I was out of my mind, was a spiritual awakening, because I saw myself in a way that I had never been able to see myself before. And once I knew, oh, is this what I'm working with? You know what, maybe once I could see the truth, I couldn't see the truth. I had no self-awareness at all. I had no idea how I got here. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know what I didn't like. I didn't understand anything. And I just came to meetings. And I got involved and I did service, which was really carrying the mess to the message. I don't know what the message, all I said was, come, let's go. We're going to the meeting. That's it. And you know what? Through coming, I started to wake up and I began to get involved and I began to do the work in the steps, and I've been doing that ever since, and it's been truly amazing. I did service from the very beginning. I got a group. I got a sponsor. Not easy to sponsor. I'm the very super self-reliant personality type. I'll sponsor you, but I won't avail myself of sponsorship. I'm very self-reliant. That's a terrible handicap because I don't allow myself the benefit of being led somewhere. Very hard. I work with it, and I'm aware of it, and I allow myself to be sponsored one day at a time, and I allow AA's hold to sponsor me, and I allow the people who I'm attracted to engage me, and I follow them. And I've met some incredible people in this program who have... I do well from seeing the warnings and following the warnings as well as the promises of the people that I see. A lot of people have saved my life through the errors that they made or the slip-ups that they've done and their courage to share it. And I want to thank those people for saving my life because I respond well to that stuff. And I learn from other people's mistakes, which is an incredible gift that is. I think we get to do that a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, by doing that stuff and by being open-minded to new ideas. And I got a sponsor. She was a young girl. I have an affinity for young people, and here we are in this group. Certainly when I started to come to the Atlantic group, it was not a young... Van said, this is not what we had in mind, you know? And how exciting it is, you know? To be a group elder is hysterical, okay? I am, like, not having it, all right? Okay. Anyway, But I love the, my first sponsor was young. She was 18, and I was 32 when I came in. I loved her, and she saved my life, and I saw myself in her, and I saw that I was alcoholic when I was her age, because I identified with her. And when she picked up that drink, I once said, oh, no, we are like people who have lost their legs. We never grow new ones, because I saw myself in her, and I could see the progression. But I really surrendered to my innermost self. I knew I really was an alcoholic of the type this book describes, and that I really needed to do what they did. And I got that next piece of surrender, and I dug into this program, and I keep doing that. And the steps are amazing, and just the whole process of inventory and learning how to take one's inventory is one of the greatest. The mechanics of doing the inventory process is one of the greatest gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially for me, because when I do that, it right-sizes my ego, which I didn't even think. I didn't understand that I had a big ego, because I thought I was less than. But having low self-esteem is an egomaniac. Who am I to say that I'm any less than anybody else? It's equally as grandiose as someone who thinks they're better than. It's reverse pride. But I didn't understand any of that, and I'm so glad that I stayed and people explained it, people whose sobriety that I really admire and I want to be like. And my through a series of events, I befriended a guy in this program who was just what a great example of AA, and he just, the way that he would carry the message was such that we all could really learn these tools and really apply them, and use inventory as a way of right-sizing my ego and as a platform to bring what I find to God in this loving manner and say, you know, this is what's getting in my way. Help me with this. Very different than anything I'm going to root out my defects of character. Root. I can't root them out. Just like, don't think about it. Why don't you just put flashcards in front of my head? All I'll do is think about whatever that thing is that you're telling me not to. Don't touch that. Do you know who you're talking to? Anyway, it's good. And to be a part of this group and to grow up amongst you and to stay here and to learn how to grow and develop friendships and practicing principles before personalities. You know, it's not easy to be in a community with people day after day, month after month, year after year, you know. And these steps and this fellowship and the principles help me to navigate that stuff in a way that's, I just think it's great. For me, I don't like to make decisions based on resentments or based on fears. And the gift is that I can use the inventory process, the steps of this program, get the stuff down to its right size so that I can allow the God of my understanding to give me the kind of guidance so I can make a more God-directed decision. It works out much better. You know, I always find it suspect when it's the greatest group in the world and then 3 months later is, I hate that group. That's alcoholism. Or someone's the greatest sponsor in the world and then we don't speak anymore. That's alcoholism. But with AA and these steps and all of you, a day at a time, I don't have to make that kind of choice in my life. I get to get guidance that's more God-directed, and I couldn't do it without you, so thank you.